From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Good afternoon and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Tuesday edition, what the Washington Post declared had begun exactly 3 years ago yesterday when President Trump was sworn in as the 45th President of the United States continues today in the U.S. Senate, the campaign to impeach President Trump. John Malcolm, Vice President of the Institute for Constitutional Government at the Heritage Foundation, joins me with a preview of the Senate impeachment process and what we can expect over the next several days. And tomorrow marks the 47th anniversary of the infamous Roe v. Wade decision that overturned state laws protecting the unborn from elective abortions. It's resulted in the killing of nearly 60 million unborn babies. Last week, the House Pro-Life Caucus held a special order drawing attention to the travesty of abortion. South Carolina Congressman Ralph Norman told a personal and moving story about his most recent grandchild. He joins us later here on Washington Watch. When it comes to the issue of abortion, a lot of the focus this week is on Washington, D.C., because after all, it was the Supreme Court that imposed abortion on the nation. However, there is a rising tide of opposition to abortion as states have passed close to 500 pro-life laws in the last decade, nearly 40% of them being passed since the Supreme Court decision in 1973, just in the last decade. One governor is calling upon the people of his state to pray for the end of abortion, Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts. He joins us here on Washington Watch. Also, there's another pushback coming from the states, the effort to use children as pawns in the effort to bring social chaos with the anti-scientific, anti-moral transgenderism. South Dakota is the latest state seeking to protect minors by making it illegal to prescribe puberty-blocking drugs or perform gender reassignment surgeries on underage children. The bill's author joins us with the details. And finally, a massive Second Amendment rally in Virginia yesterday as a Democratic-controlled government is poised to place significant restrictions on gun ownership in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, the Executive Vice President of FRC and a resident of Virginia, joins me for that discussion. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it's at T Perkins. And men, let me remind you, still to come, some of our Stand Courageous conferences this coming weekend, Kernersville, North Carolina, and then the end of the month at Marcus Point Baptist Church in Pensacola. To find out more, go to TonyPerkins.com. All right. For only the third time in U.S. history, an American president is facing an impeachment trial. The Senate trial, which began just hours ago, is marked with extreme partisanship. What is the process and what can we expect to see over the next several days? Joining me now to break it down is a man who wears many different hats, Vice President of the Institute for Constitutional Government, Director of the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, and Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, John Malcolm. John, welcome to Washington Watch.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
All right, John, we're just hours out of the gate here with the trial in the Senate. Any surprises yet?
No, nor do I expect there to be any surprises, at least during this first part of the trial. So they're having a big debate today and sort of quasi-opening statements where the Democrats are pushing to try to get the senators to agree up front to call witnesses and which witnesses they will call. Senator McConnell is saying, no, we're going to more or less follow the same rules that we followed for the Clinton impeachment trial in 1999. We are going to give the House managers 24 hours to make their case, the president's lawyers 24 hours to rebut their case, up to 16 hours from the senators to ask questions of either side. And then there will be votes on first whether to dismiss the charges outright or whether to call witnesses, and if so, which witnesses to call. I expect that that is the way this is going to go. I don't think the Democrats are going to get their way today, so I believe that Senator McConnell's rules of the road will prevail. But the interesting question is going to be at the end of this initial period of the trial, will the charges be dismissed or will there be witnesses and how long will that take?
Well, Mitch McConnell kind of challenging his colleagues to look at the tasks before them with objectiveness and with all sincerity. He had these comments. I want to play this clip from Senator Mitch McConnell.
Can the Senate still serve our founding purpose? Can we still put fairness, even-handedness, and historical precedent ahead of the partisan passions of the day?
Now, you wrote a piece, and in fact, I made reference to the topic at the beginning of the program. When Donald Trump was sworn in 3 years ago yesterday, in fact, I was on the steps of the Capitol when that occurred, the Washington Post already going out with the story, the headline, the impeachment process begins. There have been those from the very beginning that were looking for a reason to remove Donald Trump from office.
Yeah, there's no question that's true. So Representative Al Green of Texas, within, I think, a couple of weeks of the president's inauguration, had introduced the first article of impeachment. The whistleblower's attorney, Mark Zaid, 10 days after inauguration, that was the day that President Trump fired Acting Attorney General Sally Yates, said the impeachment process has begun. You referred to it as hashtag coup, and basically called in the lawyers. So people have been stealing for this for quite some time. I think the Democrats thought that the smoking gun was going to come from in the special counsel Bob Mueller's investigation. That turned out to be more of a pop gun than a smoking gun. And they have since latched on to Ukraine and the president's call with President Vladimir Zelensky. And I don't think that they have persuaded any Democrats. In the House, they approved two articles of impeachment. There were a couple of crossover Democrats who voted with the Republicans. Nobody on the Republican side voted in favor of either article of impeachment. And I don't know exactly what the final tally will be in the Senate, but there is absolutely no way that there are going to be 67 senators who will vote to remove President Trump on either of these articles of impeachment. That just won't happen.
I want to get into the mechanics of this for the benefit of our listeners in just a moment, John. But first, continuing this line of thinking, those leading this parade for impeachment ran into a little bit of a problem along the way. And I would suggest that problem is the American people who are not buying it. In fact, the poll numbers, Gallup numbers out, show that Donald Trump has the highest approval rating yet of his presidency. And you make the point in the piece that you wrote that ultimately the American people will decide this, that they are the ones that will issue the ultimate verdict in November of 2020.
Yeah, they certainly will. The only way that will not happen is if the Senate were, for reasons that I cannot fathom, were to convict the president, remove him from office, and then vote to bar him from future federal office, which is what the Democrats want to have done. But, I just don't see that happening. I mean, there are, 45 Democratic senators, two independents who usually vote with the Democrats. If they all stick together, you would have to get 20 Republican senators to cross over and vote to convict and remove Donald Trump. And since I don't see any way, based on the evidence that has been presented or would likely come up during this trial, then yes, I think that both sides are playing to the electorate. Didn't work out so well for the Republicans during the Clinton impeachment trial. Here, I don't know. I think that there are very, very few undecideds when it comes to President Trump. But, this will come down to how a few undecideds in a few swing states, how they feel about this whole thing.
Yeah, when it's all said and done, this may be one of those occasions where the Democrats actually wish they had learned from history instead of trying to rewrite it. Let me go to process now, John Malcolm. As our listeners, a lot of people, this is only the third time it's happened, so it's not like this happens every day and people knows how it works, but it has been unfolding for weeks now. But the president, articles of impeachment, he was impeached in the House. That's like an indictment, a charge. He now goes to court, using the common terms, in the Senate. The Senate hears the evidence. They're the ones that issue the verdict. How long might this last?
Well, the Clinton trial, the Andrew Johnson trial took weeks and weeks. It certainly won't be that. The Clinton trial, as I recall, took 6 weeks. If they decide to render a judgment here without hearing witnesses, this will be over within 2 weeks. And if they decide to hear witnesses, it, depending on how many witnesses they call, it could go 5 or 6 weeks. I don't think it's going to. But look, the Republicans have 53, which is a slim majority. And if the Democrats were to somehow persuade 4 Republicans to cross over and vote for witnesses, then we'd likely hear from witnesses.
You know, and the senators that I've spoken to on this, I've spoken to quite a few. I mean, they understand the gravity of their responsibility as senators to not only handle this situation, but be guardians of the precedent of the Senate. So I think they want to do due diligence. I've not heard anyone that would suggest that they think that there is something here. Most everybody sees this as what it is. It's politically motivated, as we talked about earlier. It was hatched day one. I think it comes down to, and I guess I should put this in the form of a question, but do you think it's the policies of this president that has the left so animated and energized in wanting to remove him from office? What is it about Donald Trump that they cannot stand?
Well, I think it's a combination of his policies, which are an anathema to their progressive agenda. And also, the president's style is rather unique, I would say. And he has been known to rub some people the wrong way, including former members of his cabinet. So they probably object to him both for the substance of his policies and also for for his way of doing things.
Well, that's actually a good point, because he's one of the few Republicans I have seen that actually pushes back and stands up to the left. Usually it's the Republicans that are compromising and giving ground when the Democrats don't.
Well, it's a fair point. I mean, look, this president has made it quite clear from the very beginning that he is a counterpuncher, and that if you hit him, if you come to a knife fight, he's going to be showing up with a gun. And that is the way he acts. It is, not in keeping with the way any other president has acted, although certainly people like Barack Obama accusing Republicans of clinging to their guns and their Bible. And he certainly said very offensive things. Hillary Clinton, who wanted to be president, talking about a basket of deplorables. They have certainly used harsh language, and this president certainly uses harsh language as well.
John Malcolm, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your insights on a topic that has a lot of attention right now all across America.
Great to be with you.
All right, John Malcolm, to find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com, and you can follow the links over. I think he's absolutely right. I think it's 60%, maybe 70% his policies, especially after he's already there. I mean, what he has done on the life issue, religious liberty issue, dismantling the left's infrastructure, it's driving them crazy. But then I also think it's the fact that he pushes back. It's not a typical Republican style. He's a street fighter, and he shows it. But he's getting things done. All right, coming up next, tomorrow is the 47th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. South Carolina Congressman Ralph Norman participated in a special order discussion on the House floor last week. He joins us to talk about it here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
Join FRC Live via webcast for the 15th annual Pro-Life Con Digital Action Summit. On January 24th, from FRC's headquarters in Washington, you'll hear from political leaders, bloggers, journalists, and activists who will share how they view social media and other digital tools to further the pro-life message. You'll be empowered to better reach your own communities by learning best practices from those who are at the cutting edge of the digital pro-life movement. Tune in Friday, January 24th at 8 a.m. at prolifecon.com.
We all need to be lectured sometimes. Family Research Council's new podcast features selected talks by top thinkers from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast podium takes on tough issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Listen with us to the lecture, then stick around afterward as we break down the content. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Ever hear the term toxic masculinity? Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council. Masculinity is under attack in our culture. The American Psychological Association released guidelines declaring traditional masculinity ideology as harmful. Brown University, an Ivy League school, offered a course, Unlearning Toxic Masculinity, explaining that rigid definitions of masculinity are toxic to men's health. And a University of Texas class, Masculine UT, treated masculinity as if it were a mental health crisis. Thankfully, the culture does not have the last word on true masculinity. God does. Our Stand Courageous Men's conferences offer biblical solutions to the crisis of manhood. We seek to help men develop character, cultivate habits, build relationships, and make commitments that will move them closer to God's design. Check out StandCourageous.com for an event in your area. That's StandCourageous.com. What other trip to Israel can you take that combines walking where Jesus walked with meeting today's Israeli leaders? This is Tony Perkins, president of Family Research Council, inviting you to spend an incredible 9 days in Israel with me, General Jerry Boykin, and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann from June the 2nd through the 12th. You'll discover the roots of your faith and learn from experts about the geopolitical landscape of the region. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
What are you reading this winter? Looking for timely and original commentary on human dignity, marriage, and religious liberty? We've got you covered at FRCblog.com. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, FRC staff, as well as outside contributors. Read about a wide variety of topics like crimes in the criminal state of China, how Game of Thrones mainstreamed sexual exploitation, transgender regret, the rise of the detransitioners, and many more. Stand for truth by staying informed at FRCblog.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad that you are with us on this Tuesday afternoon. All right, tomorrow marks the 47th anniversary of the infamous Roe v. Wade decision that overturned state laws protecting the unborn. It's resulted in the killing of nearly 60 million unborn babies. Last week, the House Pro-Life Caucus held a special order. That's a series of speeches made within an hour after the main business comes to a close at the end of the day. Nearly, I think it was almost three dozen members went down to the House floor and spoke about the travesty of abortion. South Carolina Congressman Ralph Norman told a personal and moving story about the birth of his most recent grandchild. Joining me now is Congressman Ralph Norman. He represents the 5th Congressional District of South Carolina. Congressman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, glad to be here, Tony. Appreciate what you're doing.
Well, you were among many that went to the House floor last week in this special order. In fact, we played a clip of your speech on the program last week. Because you were, it was a moving story. You were moved by it. What caused you to want to share? And I want you, some of our listeners may not have heard you sharing about the premature birth of your, I guess it was your latest grandchild, and the complications there, and just drawing the parallel of what we do to save these lives, but yet at the same time we treat them in a very callous way in some cases and dispose of them as if they had no value.
Yeah, it really was, Tony. It, you know, to particularly with Roe v. Wade and the anniversary coming up, our situation really put a light on something that is treated cavalier by the left, and it shouldn't be tolerated. But in our case, we had got four children, got 17 grandchildren, and our oldest daughter had never had a problem with birth. She's got five. And we got a call on the 25th, September 25th, and she was having trouble, which was, you know, really rare for her because the only thing she's ever had with her other five pregnancies is morning sickness. But anyway, was born at 25 weeks. It stayed in the NICU, a little boy, for right at 104 days. The due date was January 6th. And came home on January 7th. But, you know, at 25 weeks to see a child, you know, he was fighting for life. And he couldn't, with his skin, being that young, we couldn't even hold him. And it was just something to see. And fortunately, everything turned out well. He's healthy. He's got a hernia, but that's the only complications that or the only surgery that he'll have. So it was, as all the talks were, very moving.
Well, when you think about it, as I listen to your story, tell the story of your daughter, by the way, it's obvious you're pro-life. You've got the evidence that follows you around, 17 grandchildren. That's impressive. I imagine holidays are exciting around your place when everybody gets together. But when I listen to your story of the effort, the concern, the prayer, the attention given to this 25-week-old baby, your grandson, to bring him to a point where he is now healthy, he's at home. But then you have other children the same age that are discarded as if they are not important. And yes, it's true that your grandson born into a loving family who wanted him and loved him, but that's not what gave him his value. What gave him his value is that he was created in the image of God, and it's dependent upon us and incumbent upon us to love them and to receive those children.
Absolutely. It's a human life. And I was with some people last night, and we were talking about, you know, my grandson. They said, you know, think about the 60 million babies that were aborted. Think about what we're losing with what could be a person who contributes to society, a famous, I mean, you name it, athlete, you know, poet, whatever, the lives that are taken cavalierly.
Right.
And it just makes it, with us seeing it this close and personal, it makes you want to fight.
Right.
And you just don't, you can't do this. And that's, you know, the good news about all this, it puts a light on it, I know, for us and for me as a member of Congress, to fight for this, because the left has no moral high ground to do what they're doing or to allow to for these children to be killed. And that's the only way to say it. These children are being killed, and they have no right to do that.
Well, Congressman Ralph Norman, you are fighting for those things on Capitol Hill. It's evident. We appreciate what you do for the unborn, for the family, and for religious freedom. And we thank you for joining us here today on Washington Watch.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Tony. Thank you for what you do.
All right. Keep up the good work. Congressman Ralph Norman of South Carolina. You know, this ultimately comes down to what we understand and what we believe about human life. And this is a part of the process of taking God out of the equation, where we just happen to be here. We're not created by God. And then, of course, we're now to the point where we can determine our own sex. We create ourselves is essentially what we are embarking upon now. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. But, folks, here's what it comes down to. And this is why we have to uphold truth. Every human being, regardless of what zip code they may have been conceived in or what side of the track they were born on, have value. Why? Because they were created in the image of God. In this case, with Congressman Norman and his family loving, fighting for this child, some children don't have someone loving them. In fact, they want to discard them. That should not determine the future of that child. And that's where society has to stand up, in our laws and defending the unborn, but also in our own homes, in our lives. Taking those who are outcast, discarded by society. That's why adoption needs to be a higher priority in the things that we pursue and discuss. All right, we're going to continue our conversation about the life issue. When we come back, this is not just a national issue here in Washington, D.C., but it's an issue that is being addressed all across America. In fact, one governor has called for a nation or a statewide day of prayer to end abortion tomorrow. Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts, he joins us next to talk about it. Don't go away. More Washington Watch to come right after this.
Last year, my brother Josh, a 37-year-old married father with 5 kids under the age of 9, announced he was becoming a woman. Josh changed his name to Melissa and now requires everyone to use she, her pronouns when referring to him. If the grandparents refuse to do this, they've been threatened with limited access to their grandchildren. My tall, handsome, muscular brother began taking strong female hormones that transformed him into a different person. He began wearing dresses, wigs, heels, and makeup in public. He will have to stay on female hormones until the day he dies. He refuses to answer to the name Josh now. He says Josh is dead. There was even some type of symbolic burial ceremony to say goodbye to Josh, once and for all. You've been listening to an excerpt from a 6-part series telling the true account of a family impacted by the transgender movement. To read this important blog series, visit frc.org/cult.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council and host of Washington Watch. I invite you to join our family and thousands of others across the country in standing on the Word of God as we go into 2020, the global year of the Bible, by joining in a 2-year family chronological Bible reading plan. I can assure you that your family will be powerfully impacted by reading God's Word and growing in the understanding of His truth together. The readings take only 15 to 20 minutes a day, with Sundays set aside for a family or small group discussion. To join us, simply go to TonyPerkins.com and click on Stand on the Word with FRC. That's TonyPerkins.com or call 800-225-4008. That's 800-225-4008. Let's stand together on the Word of God and change the world, beginning in our own home. Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. So good to have you with us. The website is TonyPerkins.com. Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts declared January the 22nd a statewide day of prayer to end abortion. In his proclamation, he stated in part, quote, "It seems right and fitting that the citizens of the state of Nebraska are urged to pray for an end to abortion and for our fellow citizens who need our love and support," end quote. Joining me now from the Cornhusker State is Governor Ricketts himself. Governor, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, sir. Let me begin with the most obvious question. What led you to declare a day of prayer to end abortion?
Well, Nebraska is a pro-life state. You see it all over, from the people who attend prayer vigils to the people who work in pregnancy agencies and volunteer there, to the work that our families do to help support one another. And we believe that what has happened with Roe versus Wade is one of the darkest periods of our nation's history, with over 60 million of our children being killed. And so we wanted to ask for prayer to end abortion. And I think it recognizes the limits of our humanity. It recognizes that we're talking about changing hearts and minds, and we need God's help to be able to do that. And so we wanted to bring people together in that cause of praying for the end of abortion, to be able to continue to work toward making this a country that respects life again.
You know, it reminds me of Luke chapter 18, where Lord Jesus Christ, talking to his disciples, said that men ought to pray and not lose heart. And 47 years into this battle for the sanctity of human life in our country, many people have grown discouraged, although I would say that there is certainly movement in a very positive way right now. As I mentioned earlier in the program, just in the last decade, 500 pro-life laws have come forth from the states. That's 40% of all pro-life laws passed since 1973. And in your proclamation, you not only call for prayer, but kind of what Jesus said in that parable about the widow and the unjust judge was not only to pray, but to pursue justice. And you call upon citizens to take action, to aid mothers, fathers, and families in need, especially those expecting a child who cannot provide for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely, because pro-life is not just a slogan, and it's not just about ending abortion. It's an important part of what we do is to try to end abortion. But it's also remembering that we've got people in our community that need our help. That's a pro-life message. So whether it's helping families who needed food assistance, women who have been trafficked, anybody who needs our help, that's what pro-life is really about, is recognizing that dignity that is innate to each and every one of us. And really, again, since we just had Martin Luther King Jr. Day, to ask, what are we doing for others? That was the fundamental, what he called the most urgent, persistent question of life. What are we doing for others?
And a key part of that when it comes to the pro-life movement, I just had Congressman Ralph Norman of South Carolina. We're talking about his most recent grandbaby born at 25 weeks. They fought for him. That child is now home doing well. In that case, a child loved and welcomed into the world. For those children that are not welcomed into the arms, loving arms of parents, this is another place the community needs to reach out to, and adoption should be a very prominent option.
Absolutely. Adoption and all the other things we can do to be able to take care of the children in our communities. And it really does require community involvement, people at the local level to do that. The state of Nebraska was just awarded an award for the work we're doing, for example, in foster care, to be more preventative with families so we can keep children and families together. In fact, we've reduced out-of-home placements in foster care now 18% over the last 2 years. And that, again, to me, that's another example of how we live out our lives as being a pro-life culture.
Let me ask you this question, Governor Ricketts, because I see this quite frequently when a governor, a mayor, even the president calls for a day of prayer, one of these proclamations, you get these voices saying, oh, that's a violation of the separation of church and state, even though our history is filled with examples of this. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, the separation of church and state is not anywhere in our Constitution. So that's the first thing people should know. And what our Constitution does in our First Amendment is actually say that the government shall not abridge our right to freedom of religion. And in fact, our founders believe that not only it was necessary that we have religion to be able to keep our republic, that those moral values that are instilled by religion are important for us to actually be self-governing. And of course, we have our First Amendment rights, which allows us to be able to talk about our religious values. And so I think that's one of the things that people really misunderstand about the nature of our Constitution, is that freedom of religion does not mean freedom from religion, that our founders absolutely believed the public square was a place where we express our religious values. And as an elected official, I have First Amendment, I get that same right as everybody else to be able to express my religious values in the public square.
Well, Governor Ricketts, I want to thank you for utilizing that First Amendment freedom, for protecting that First Amendment freedom and promoting it, especially in this case on behalf of the unborn. And thanks so much for joining us today.
Great. Hey, thank you very much, Tony. I appreciate having me on.
All right. Governor Pete Ricketts of Nebraska. More governors should do similar proclamations. I know the governor of Tennessee has been out with proclamations for prayer. Hopefully we'll see more governors. And the more we pray, we see men and women of deep, abiding faith stepping into these positions that are willing to stand strong and not shrink back out of fear of the left. Fear. It silences. It robs. Be bold. Be courageous. All right, coming up next, we go to South Dakota, where lawmakers there are trying to protect children from the left's agenda. That's next. Don't go away.
What are you reading this winter? Looking for timely and original commentary on human dignity, marriage, and religious liberty? We've got you covered at frcblog.com. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, FRC staff, as well as outside contributors. Read about a wide variety of topics like crimes in the criminal state of China, how Game of Thrones mainstreamed sexual exploitation, transgender regret, the rise of the detransitioners, and many more. Stand for truth by staying informed at frcblog.com.
A strong case can now be made that China has become one of the most totalitarian states in human history. The Chinese Communist Party restricts religious practice and oppresses religious minorities on a sweeping scale, targeting those of every faith, especially Christians, Muslims, Tibetan Buddhists, and Falun Gong. The Chinese Communist Party's movement against religion has had and continues to have devastating consequences for those who simply wish to live according to their conscience. The Chinese Communist Party's consistent abuses of human rights prove that it cannot be treated just like any other country. The United States must address these human rights and religious freedom violations in their trade and diplomatic dealings with China. For more information about the human rights crisis in China, visit frc.org/China. That's frc.org/China.
In the U.S., the rate of chemical abortions is at an all-time high. This increase is being driven by the abortion industry, which wants abortion pills available through the pharmacy in the mail, making do-it-yourself abortions the future of the abortion industry. Abortion advocates once claimed that legal abortion would prevent back-alley abortions, but the health complications that often result from chemical abortion are eerily similar to those of back-alley abortions. For more information, visit frc.org/chemical-abortion. Last year, my brother Josh, a 37-year-old married father with 5 kids under the age of 9, announced he was becoming a woman. Josh changed his name to Melissa and now requires everyone to use she, her pronouns when referring to him. If the grandparents refuse to do this, they've been threatened with limited access to their grandchildren. My tall, handsome, muscular brother began taking strong female hormones that transformed him into a different person. He began wearing dresses, wigs, heels, and makeup in public. He will have to stay on female hormones until the day he dies. He refuses to answer to the name Josh now. He says Josh is dead. There was even some type of symbolic burial ceremony to say goodbye to Josh, once and for all. You've been listening to an excerpt from a 6-part series telling the true account of a family impacted by the transgender movement. To read this important blog series, visit frc.org/cult.
Watch, and I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, a new sexual and gender revolution has seemed to unravel rapidly over the past several years. Male and female genders that have existed from the beginning of time have now morphed into many different genders. In fact, it's hard to keep up with just how many there are. With this confusion, gender transition surgery is becoming commonplace as it is being widely promoted. After stories have surfaced of parents transitioning their children, South Dakota has a bill to ban gender transition surgery for minors. Joining me to talk about it is State Representative Fred Deutsch, who serves the 4th District of South Dakota. Representative Deutsch, thanks so much for joining us today on the program.
Pleased to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. Let me make sure I get the facts of this right. This is designed to address the issue of minor children. We're talking about underage children who are either being given drugs, which block puberty, or gender reassignment surgeries, much of which all of this is non-reversible.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. So the bill addresses puberty blockers, as well as cross-sex hormones, in other words, testosterone given to girls and estrogen given to boys in ultra-high mega doses, as well as, you know, mastectomies and what they call the bottom surgeries. Yes, irreversible.
Now, there have been medical experts that have testified that, as you pointed out, these are not most of this is not reversible, but it can create long-term physical problems, health problems, that some of which we're not even aware of yet because this is so new. But there's also psychological problems that accompany this. As I read about this, you were prompted in part to do this because of the testimonies of those who have gone through this, now looking back saying this was a mistake.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, my involvement through this was really, I don't know if you want to call it accidental or innocent, but I just ran across stories of pain and suffering from young people on the internet, Twitter, and then I was led to a couple of sites on Reddit. I'd never been on there before. I didn't even know it existed, but it's where a lot of these children that are hurting go, and they share their stories of pain and misery, and many of them just didn't understand what they're getting themselves into. So that moved me. You know, it's hard not to be compassionate when you care about kids, and it moved me to research if any of this was being done in South Dakota, and I found it was.
In promoting the concept of your bill, you were quoted as saying that we know from the literature that approximately 85% of children that are confused about whether or not they are a boy or a girl, that confusion goes away naturally within time. What we're doing is locking them into a momentary feeling which has implications for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, so, you know, the folks on the other side of the argument talk about puberty blockers as being a pause button. And I'm saying, you know what, a much better pause button is just don't give them the drugs or surgeries. You know, let them wait. Because according to the literature and all the studies over some 40 years, on average, about 85% of these kids will just come to acknowledge their normal, natural birth that they're born with if you don't mess with them with drugs or surgery. So isn't that a much better, quote, pause button? I think so.
And you have drawn some opposition to this bill. There are some of your colleagues on the other side of the aisle, but I would say this is not necessarily a partisan bill. You have Democratic support. I would say it's the ideological line on the other side. Some claiming that this bill interferes with the doctor-patient relationship. How do you respond to the criticism of this bill?
Well, you know, if you care about kids, I think you have to prioritize them. And, you know, in South Dakota, we don't allow mutilation of our children. I don't care if it's doctors. I don't care if it's parents. You know, these kids on the internet, they share these pictures of themselves that just blow you away of all these surgical scars. And it's terrible. That should not ever be allowed. To me, that's a crime against humanity when these procedures are done by these so-called doctors, you know, that dance on the edge of medicine. I just don't think it should be done. I'm a son of a Holocaust survivor. I've had family members killed in Auschwitz, and I've seen the pictures of the bizarre medical experiments. I don't want that to happen to our kids, and that's what's going on right now.
It is so true. And so many of these procedures, in fact, many of these puberty-blocking drugs that are being used were not intended originally for these purposes. We don't even know the long-term implications and health effects related to the usage as they're currently being used in these children. And,
that's,
you know,
right.
I would go back to the opposition here, not that this necessarily applies to South Dakota, but those that are saying that, well, this should be between a patient and doctor. Well, you know what? These same folks didn't have that concern when they're blocking counseling, selective or voluntary counseling that patients who are dealing with same-sex attractions or gender dysphoria, they're blocking them from getting the counseling that they want in some states.
Yeah.
So
this,
I think, is a prudent measure that simply protects children from making a decision that is influenced by momentary feelings that, as I mentioned earlier, would have lifelong consequences. I commend you for stepping forward and offering this legislation.
No, thank you. It's been a time of great stress for me, as you might imagine. We get email, and I praise God whenever I get email in support. And they are running more in support than in opposition, but some people just cannot communicate opposition without going overboard. And so it has been a stressful time, and I'm grateful for your comments and your support.
Representative Deutsch, one final thing. You have a hearing on this bill in committee tomorrow, if I'm correct. Is that right?
That's right, 7:45 a.m. Central Time.
All right. And this is the first stop, if I'm not mistaken, for this bill?
Yes, that's right. First stop. If we can pass it out of committee, it then goes to the full House. If we can pass it out of the House, then it goes to the Senate, and the process happens over again with committee and then the floor. And then finally, it'll go to the governor's desk for her consideration.
All right. Well, Representative Deutsch, we will be closely following this as it makes its way through the process. And again, we commend you for your concern for children and your courage to stand up and do what is right.
Thank you very much.
All right. State Representative Deutsch from South Dakota. To find out more about his bill, go to TonyPerkins.com. In fact, we'll give you an update tomorrow. We'll talk a little bit more about this. FRC has some model legislation as it pertains to this topic because it is a big issue. It really came to prominence in Texas with the 7-year-old boy there whose mother and father going through a divorce. Mother wanted to transition the boy at 7 to a girl. That, again, gained national attention. And as a result, several states, Texas, Kentucky, in addition to South Dakota and a couple others, are looking at similar legislation. All right. In just a moment, I'm going to bring in our own Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin to talk about the big Second Amendment rally that took place in Virginia yesterday. But first, I'm going to ask you this question. Friends, have you ever considered traveling to Israel, or would you like to go again? Well, I invite you and your family and friends to spend an incredible 9 days in the Holy Land with me, with my next guest, General Jerry Boykin, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. We'll be going June the 2nd through the 12th. Not only will the Bible come alive in transforming ways, but you'll hear directly from Israeli defense, political, and religious leaders about what's happening right now in Israel and in the Middle East. It is it's really the epicenter of all that's happening in the Middle East. It's a one-of-a-kind tour. To find out more how you can join us in this life-changing tour of the Holy Land, go to TonyPerkins.com and follow the links over. All right. Yesterday, there was a massive rally in Virginia to push back against the Democratic-controlled legislature and the governor in restrictive gun bills. Now, this is another example of the consequences of elections. The legislature there flipping hands, and now the Democratic governor who's been there pushing for, again, very restrictive gun legislation. Joining me now to talk about this is our own Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, Executive Vice President here at the Family Research Council. General, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you, Tony, and I'm glad to be on for this topic, especially since this is the state I live in.
Right, and that's, you know a little bit about guns, but you know a little bit about Virginia. You and I have been talking about this because the citizens of Virginia are not taking this sitting down. They are pushing back, and I think it's a great educational moment on how our system of government works in terms of we have decentralized government. You know, we know that in terms of our 50 states and the federalist system, but it also works within the state as well. And I want to talk about that in a moment. But first, give us the latest on how yesterday's rally went and this pushback against Governor Northam and the Democrats who are trying to snatch guns.
Yeah, well, the legislature has outlined what they intend to pass and put before the governor Blackface Northam, and it is it's got several components in there that the citizens of most of Virginia are just not willing to accept. It's got the red line laws. It's got one handgun a month. purchase. It's got universal background checks. It's got restrictions on certain types of weapons, and certainly you can read those as what they call assault weapons, whatever that is, and then high-capacity magazines. And the citizens in most of the counties and many of the cities in Virginia have said this is unconstitutional. Our sheriffs and our police chiefs will not uphold this law and or enforce this law, and therefore we are going to declare ourselves sanctuary counties or sanctuary cities, and it is about 90 counties now, and I think it's somewhere around 20 cities or towns. And the people are rising up, and that's what you call the right to petition your government for the redress of grievances, what you saw in Richmond at the Capitol yesterday.
Of course, going into that rally, they were trying to make, you know, parallels to the rally in Charlottesville that ended up with, you know, violent occurrences there when there was a clash between the parties. This time, several, you know, tens of thousands of people gathered there to address the legislators' push to take away guns or restrict gun ownership. But you have in the state, as you pointed out, you have about 90 counties that have declared themselves as sanctuary cities for the Second Amendment. This is where I go, what I was making reference to earlier, about the decentralized nature of our government. And this is a biblical concept. You know, Abraham, Moses was instructed to kind of break down government so it was decentralized. We see at the Tower of Babel where there was this unified government and it was going to lead to no good purposes. And the Lord, you know, separated them and it was decentralized. Here you have sheriffs who are saying, we're not going to enforce this law. It is an unconstitutional law, an infringement on the Second Amendment. We're not going to enforce it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I would encourage the listeners to go to YouTube and see what some of these sheriffs actually said. Some of them gave incredibly articulate statements in terms of what was at stake here. And I was actually very, very proud of the state of Virginia yesterday, the people. But let me say one thing. This legislature flipped from Republican to Democratic. And I would say to you that it flipped primarily not because of the people that voted, it's because of the people that didn't vote. And a lot of these people, and God bless them for being out there in the streets and protesting this in a peaceful kind of way and articulating their objections in what I think is an appropriate way. But the question is, did you vote? Elections have consequences. If you want to avoid this from happening nationally, you better go to the polls, and you better be very careful who you vote for.
And a very, very good point to end on. General Jerry Boykin, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. Good to be with you.
All right. I can only reiterate that point, that elections have consequences, and if we don't want to see these type things play out, we need to be registered, we need to be informed, and we need to be voting. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you've taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.